Thanks to everyone for coming, and thanks to my co-panelists from California, who gave a very good overview of a program that I'm going to have to learn about, because I do a lot of interface with communities and such, and I think your models and you all's institute's experiences are very useful. My topic is a little more specific. It's not dealing with prevention in general. It's dealing with the incessant problem of lead contamination in American children. So what I wanted to do was to touch base on a lot of aspects of that intractable, multi-layered, multi-dimensional problem. I'm not a specialist in terms of engineering. I'm not a water quality specialist. I'm a generalist. You know, my training is in medical history, policy studies. But I draw from a lot of different specialties. Perhaps if questions come up after my talk or during my talk, someone in the audience will have the expertise to answer it probably better than myself. I just gave you all some take-home material. All of this is online, but I wanted to just I wanted to pass this out for people who want to get deeper into some of the subjects that we touch on when you get back home. The first page is just a cover page for a study that was done as a result of the second National People of Color Environmental Leadership Summit. The web page is at the bottom of that page, and if you go online, you type in that web address, you'll get a very thick, very extensive overview of what environmental justice movement has been doing. So I want you all to realize this is a movement that's in different states. There's a big research center down in Atlanta, headed by Dr. Bullitt down there. So you can get into the flavor and the details and the state of the environmental justice movement by going to the various websites. They have many now, and so I'm encouraging you all to do that, because you will find they're active probably in your local area if you don't know that already. But also they always give highlights. They'll give you the historical highlights of what they've been doing nationally, how they originated, what have been the key cases, the key protest areas, and so on and so forth. So that, I get that out the way. The second document is A Tale of Two Cities. And basically, this is published by, it's online, and at the bottom of the page is a phone number. And I didn't have time to put the exact source, but it's an NGO here in Washington, D.C. And if you are interested in the struggle to clean up the lead from Washington, D.C.'s water system and the water systems that serve the schools and such, the group that's associated with this particular diagram, it has a web page, and they list their projects and so on and so forth. And the other items are just some additional information I was able to locate and advise that you all look at. The schools near Superfund sites handout at the bottom of the page, it lists Citizens Environmental Coalition. If you get on their webpage, you can get the location of Superfund sites that are near schools in several states. So that's another resource you can access. And then finally, the final page is a page out of a study done by some researchers that appeared in the Journal of Public Health. And what it does is it does a review of studies, epidemiological studies, on the impact of floods in terms of releasing chemical contamination, heavy metals and such. And if you look at the second column, study design and period, if you're interested in pursuing trying to get your local environmental agencies and such to give your neighborhood information about the impact of floods and such, the different methods that have been used by researchers are listed in that second column. Some researchers have used phone calls to households, so they sample different blocks, and others use data provided by the more specialized agencies. Okay, so that's the basis for the handouts. Now let me quickly get through the body of my talk. First, what I want to do is basically cover four things. I want to look at the national situation with respect to childhood lead poisoning. Then second, I want to zero in on the drinking water and lead contamination problem as it relates to schools. And then third, I want to talk about what I should call an urban ecology model. You all would have different names. I'm sure Ms. Davies has kind of covered a lot of the things that I would put in that model, but basically it's a model or a paradigm that I suggest has to be included in our future work with respect to reducing lead exposure in children. And then finally, we'll talk about some long-term objectives. The environmental justice definition is very simple and straightforward, and you'll see it in a lot of the material that I've just mentioned to you all. It's a principle that all people and communities are entitled to equal protection of their environment, health, employment, housing, transportation, as provided by federal and local civil rights laws. The last couple of decades in the country, we witnessed a lot of effort with respect to environmental protection, and I see a lot of new information on the scene in terms of tracking pollution and making this information available to communities and such. So what I suggest is that any group that's involved in environmental health, that they consider utilizing a very broaden their lens, broaden their frame of analysis. And I just come up with the phrase urban ecology paradigm. In applying the urban ecology paradigm to the lead exposure problem with children, what I'm suggesting is that we kind of have to get away from this idea that lead contamination emerges from one or two sources, old housing and, let's say, cultural practices, which has to do with diet and such. We really have to see lead as having diffuse sources, and we'll get into that a little bit later. We also have to take into account the climate change and global warming and this broader kind of international global agenda that's beginning to emerge, that's starting to link and come into consciousness with respect to many formerly localized and national-based environmental protection movements. We also have to consider the fact that these pollutants, such as the trace metals, lead, mercury, and such, that they have an atmospheric presence. And if you look at the maps, global emission tracking maps that are available, and you know, you can try to access them as a layperson, but you can always get someone who is from these particular fields, a geophysical specialist, whether they're engineers or people who work with climate science, and they can actually go on, into the proper database and look at and express to you what I'm going to express is that the pollution that is being produced locally somewhere else in the world is now circulating globally. So 200 years ago, if we had a lot of pollution, let's say in London, it would basically stay in that particular industrial area. And when I say pollution, I mean in terms of atmospheric pollution. But now, given the size of the world population, the level of industrialization and such, that atmospheric pollution comes to this side of the globe as well. So when we do background studies, when we do studies of urban pollution, for example, we will find some of the same toxins that we have been addressing in highly specialized movements, such as lead. And then last I want to say with respect to the urban ecology model is we need to take into consideration the fact that populations are shifting, urban populations are shifting. A lot of the poorer populations are moving to older suburbs, and these are older houses, and you have the same behaviors, which was just covered in terms of the prior presentation. You have the same behaviors that tend to then open the door to health problems. So you have this demographic shift as well. So the urban ecology paradigm it needs to be considered. Okay, let's look at the national picture with respect to lead poisoning. I'm just going to point out one or two patterns that suggest, you know, smoke with respect to this issue, and then we'll zero in on drinking water. Over the past couple of decades, we know that the general numbers for blood lead levels in youth cohorts have been going down, and this dramatic drop has occurred because of the phasing out of the leaded gasoline. but what still is occurring is that subpopulations in America still have high rates of lead, high rates of children with high rates of blood lead levels. For example, 5.5% of urban children have lead, high blood lead levels, unsafe levels. That's 10 micrograms or, per deciliter. 8% of low-income children have measurably high blood lead levels. 11% of African-American children. 5% of Mexican-American children have blood lead levels that are higher in the unsafe range. Some 23% of Mexican-American children have blood lead levels that are around at 5, which you all, if you know about this area, that right now, that level now is being questioned as to whether or not it's safe. So we're talking about 28% of the Mexican-American children in this country have some measurable lead in their systems, and the scientists are still, you know, finding how destructive this situation is. When you look at class and when you look at color, what I'm saying is we see that a lot of the high exposure rates are among the people of color and the low-income people. Another big problem with respect to the national picture, and again, the first problem is that there's still a big population that does have high blood lead levels among our child cohorts. A second problem is with screening. And although there are a lot of laws with respect to screening, we miss many, many children, locally, countywide, statewide, and such. And that the chart you have up on the screen, and I don't know if you all can see the figures on the back, but basically what it is, it was a study that was done by Rand Corporation researchers. It came out in 2006. Allegheny County is a huge, very highly, heavily populated county in Pennsylvania, the Pittsburgh area. And what it shows is that it came up with an estimate for kids who have dangerous levels of blood lead. And what it shows is that in the bottom where it says total, the totals, great numbers, like 40% up to 60% of the children in these areas that we can estimate have high blood lead readings, they're not getting screened. So what we come up with is hundreds and thousands of kids who are in environments or for some reason have blood lead levels that are unsafe. They're not being screened by their particular health plans or their health care providers. There are all kinds of reasons for that. We could have five different sessions going with clinical people to explain why, and people who you know, nursing folk who could tell you why that is the case. You know, it's complications, the parents don't come back, no one on staff can do these kinds of tests, the laboratory doesn't respond, there's a lot of paperwork issues. So health plans tend to write in that the physicians or healthcare providers are supposed to screen, but what we're saying is that whatever the system is, sometimes 40 to 60% of the children in a particular community have blood lead problems, but it's not being caught in the screening process when they go in for their physicals, when their parents take them in for physicals and such. So we have two big problems with respect to lead poisoning in children. We have a lot of kids who are still joining those ranks as we speak day to day, and we have kids who are already exposed and who are in these dangerous environments on a continual basis. This brings me to the problem of lead in the schools. Now, some of you all may recall, people who are from the D.C. area, that a few years ago, a big controversy emerged about the safety of Washington, D.C. drinking water, not just in the schools, but in general. What was happening in Washington was happening in other cities around the country. Many places were finding, not just cities, but in suburban and rural areas as well, they were finding that their water had unsafe levels of lead, and when they tested the water. And in my paper, my written version, I have a long couple of sections on the federal laws that have been enacted since the 1980s to ensure safe drinking water. For example, in 1988, the Lead Contamination Control Act was enacted, and basically what it did was it made schools and daycare centers ban water coolers that had lead products in those cooler systems, either the pipes or the containers for the water. If they were identified as being unsafe, then the facility authorities had to get rid of those particular water coolers. Now, just dealing with the water coolers, we're not talking about all the piping underneath it and all the piping that goes outside the buildings. So that was one kind of like federal measure, the Lead Contamination Control Act. In 1991, the lead and copper rule law was passed, and basically this had to do with general customers, general communities, public water systems. And it required that who was ever the authority over these systems, they had to test the water on a regulated basis. And if more than 10% of the samples that they took from these water systems exceeded the safety levels, and there's a lot of figures and such that we can get into, but this is not the context. What it required was that these water authorities had to make changes, had to improve those water systems, whereby those samples would read more safely. So the water systems authorities were required to repair corroded pipes, conduct public education, and if need be, replace whole lines to get rid of these lead readings that were coming out when they sampled around the water systems. Let me quickly go to the local controversy. So here's where Washington comes in. And not just Washington, but Seattle, Philadelphia, all of these cities, if you do a kind of like a city-by-city study, you will see that around 2003, 2004, investigative reporters primarily came up with data that shocked the readership, that proved just how contaminated their water was, and particularly in the schools. Now, this is a visual that it didn't appear, but what that would be in there on the right. What appears on the left is a lead test results that were collected for Seattle public schools. And what the investigators came up with was the fact that something like 25% of the schools in Seattle had unsafe drinking water with respect to the lead levels. Now, we could spend again hours and sessions on how much of the lead that kids ingest from school, how much of that contributes to their overall blood lead levels. Different scientists say different things. Some scientists say it's minuscule, it's almost, you can't measure it. Other scientists have come up with figures like 18 to 24%. So in other words, if you have a child that has a lead poisoning problem, that lead in that child's body did not just come from the housing, indoor housing dust and things of that sort. It could come from the drinking water in their schools. So this type of information got out. There were controversies in Seattle Post-Intelligencer published a big chart showing the names of the schools, very impactful, showing the names of the schools and the fact that the drinking water in these schools was very unsafe. I have a lot of data and such, but I obviously cannot get into it now. My minutes are getting scarce. But this brings me to the urban ecology paradigm again, and why I think it's important for those who are involved in trying to eliminate lead contamination in the drinking water at schools and facilities, and trying to get the federal and state bodies to be more forceful in their regulation and implementing their regulations. This brings me to short-term or long-term solutions. And the urban ecology paradigm, I think, should push our NGOs, our academic researchers, our conscientious professionals to broaden the frame of analysis to include new dangers, new distal kinds of causes that are on the scene, new factors that are bringing new exposure pathways into the lives of the usually, again, the low-income people of color communities. One of these new factors is floods. Irving flooding. And I'm in the middle of a Bible with Johnson project looking at disasters and disadvantaged populations. We go into the communities, we talk with them, we have forums and such, we do surveys, and urban flooding is a big issue in terms of flash floods, floods that hit two or three blocks, usually in the areas that are not you know, highly covered in the press and such. And this flooding destabilizes contaminants that are on the sidewalks, that are in the sewage, and these contaminants are released into these households as indoor pollution. Okay, guess what's in those contaminants? Okay, so Chicago, for example, in 1996, it had a record rainfall on July 17th. Flash floods hit South Chicago. Can I have one or two more minutes just to wrap up? These flash floods hit South Chicago. 3.4 million people were affected. Some 35,000 homes suffered some flood damage from the rains. Commuters were trapped in Chicago for 3 days before they can get trains out of the city, out back to the suburban areas. About 85,000 people received some form of assistance because of this big local flood that occurred in the Chicago, the South Chicago, and in the suburban areas. Now, I'm talking about that flood to give you an illustration of how you can have a big change in the local environment that's brought on by an ecological factor and related to weather and this, you know, being flooding. So, if we're going to continue to struggle to eliminate lead poisoning in children, we can't just focus on having them, let's say, correct the housing that they're living in. And we can't just focus on the outreach education of the parents to have the children wash their hands. We can't just focus on fighting to get clean drinking water in the schools and in the daycare facilities. Yes, we have to continue all of those focuses, but we also have to consider the fact that we need a lot of monitoring. We need a lot of consciousness with respect to changes that are hitting our cities that have nothing to do with politicians or corporations, let's say, citing a particular waste dump or waste site. In terms of long-term goals, and as far as improving environmental health for urban children, I just listed a few. The list could be very long, but the ones that I want to underscore in my talk, we need to not only stress safe housing, but we also have to look at the structures of these neighborhoods in terms of how they handle runoff water during times of high precipitation. And what's interesting, when you look at neighborhoods and floods, you also see that there's a lot of divisions and such between different neighborhoods. Who's responsible for what type of a runoff? And America is very strange in that way. You know, we have a lot of freedoms, but sometimes our freedoms work against us because it's hard to unite communities. And we found that in doing our forums. You know, when we talk about maybe a hurricane hitting Camden, well, you know, Camden is developing their plans. They have their own emergency preparedness office. But Cherry Hill has their own plan, too. But the hurricane is not going to look, you know, at any kind of boundary like that. The hurricane would roll through Camden and Cherry Hill at pretty much at the same with the same destruction. How do you get people from Camden, basically working class people, to get the ear of people in Cherry Hill whose whole lifestyle is to stay away from the working class people? And I mentioned it to Camden, and Camden people, they can't stand the people in Cherry Hill. And they're mad with Cherry Hill because they say Cherry Hill puts all the homeless people in Camden. So when we talk about flood warning, flood management, that means we're going to have to try to unify communities that don't unify. Finally, you know, reduction of air pollution, that has to be considered as part of the struggle to reduce lead in the environment. And then I think eventually we'll have that safe drinking water in our schools and daycare facilities. So with that, I have to stop because of my time.
Sure.
why do you have to want, and we're speaking hypothetically, and you're absolutely right. A lot of this comes down to policy. And we can get into, you know, who makes the policy, who formulates the policy, who conceptualizes the policy, and who implements the policy. And we know a lot of that has to do with political willpower and political influence. You know, policy is just like the icing. The cake is the community and the different agencies and such that push the policy forward. But you're right, these are policy decisions. And the decisions now with respect to childhood lead poisoning that's being tied to drinking water in schools is to get the locals to do some testing, and hopefully you get good results. There are many, many, many issues. Believe me, some states are doing very good jobs. The ones I would say are doing quite well, I think New York State is trying to do well. New York City has very strong grassroots groups that work with the local health departments to make sure that the monitoring is effective and such. And California has a long history of looking at the drinking water problem in their schools. So those states are kind of ahead. But then if you look at a state like you look at states like the southern states, and I've read the documents that they sent to EPA. EPA did a big study of these water systems in 2004, and they've asked every state to submit to them a report as to what they're doing with respect to lead in drinking water in the schools and daycare facilities. How are they regulating? And the state sent, you know, little reports back, and if you go through them, you'll see some states basically say, we're not doing anything, you know, we don't have the money. So other states are saying, well, we have a childhood lead poisoning elimination program, and it deals with housing and such. In other words, they were just putting up a lot of words about the issue. It is policy. It also is resources. And those resources, if you're talking about like the health department versus the defense department, those are political decisions and decisions that come out of the will of the people, which brings me back to the environmental justice paradigm and the environmental justice movement. You mean the environmental justice studies or the I'm sorry, I didn't hear. Oh yeah, Durand. I'm sorry, sir. You know, it came out within the past year, and basically it went to the health providers and health plans of Pennsylvania. That's who it was targeted for. The impact, I don't know. The data I gave was 2006, so I'm sure it's going to take a while for the data to change. But what's interesting about that RAND study is that that would probably be the case for all of the different communities that, you know, that we live and work in. In other words, the screening system as it's set up now is poor. Even when it's on the books, but for practical reasons, for lack of will, lack of resources, improper staffing or whatever, screening is not effective in this country. And you might recall in the early 1990s, if you all go back and look at the journal, there was a big debate about why are agencies taking the public health prevention approach from to childhood lead poisoning? Why are they moving it off the shelves and they're replacing it with this idea that lead poisoning is an individual illness, and that what you do is you go into an individual household and you go into an individual, you know, you get the parents and you get the landlord and such. That's a part of the correctives that you need to implement. But that's just kind of like getting the water out of the spigot. We're talking about the whole pipeline of lead exposure of children, which means you need to go back to the prevention model of the public health community of the early 1990s. So the RAND study is basically saying the system is broken. They don't get into what we've been talking about, you know, these broader questions of prevention, long-term prevention, whether it's in behavior or whether it's in environment. And what I'm trying to suggest is that the environmental justice paradigm is the key paradigm because it requires safe housing, transportation, all the basic avenues of life. And looking at the urban context and the dynamic changes that are in place now, these are the two big signposts we have to keep in mind if we do want to those RAND studies to go away. We won't need a RAND study if we eliminate, lead exposure pathways, which are multitudinous.